Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 36 of NML Crossing, where I'm recording the first few minutes of this again because I don't know if anybody out there has done recording work before and used something like Audacity, you know, the free one that everybody uses pretty much, or at least, you know, on PC. You know, you can use, what is it, GarageBand on Apple things. But it did that thing today where, like, I went to listen back to, because I goof up all the time. I edit as I go. I mean, this is my professional podcasting methodology here. I edit as I go. So if I flub a line, I scrub and I fix and I start over. I start over from where I messed up. So I made it about 4 minutes into the episode before messing up, which is really good for me. And so I go to listen back, and the audio's playing from my computer, not the microphone or the headphones. It's like, crap. It did that thing where it decided not to acknowledge the fact that there's a microphone plugged in. So I was recording into my laptop and hearing myself out of the laptop, and it was even tinnier than usual. So here we go again. Anyway, today we are still on that road. And we're still in Asriel land, and, well, I'm afraid this might be a very short episode, or I was afraid it would be a very short episode, because there just isn't a whole heck of a lot to say. I hate being negative about books, especially when I can tell that they were written, you know, in earnest. It's Denny O'Neill. I mean, he's not some guy who's gonna be phoning it in. I believe he thought that these stories were contributing to the greater No Man's Land landscape. And as such, I really don't want to harsh on them too badly. Because, you know, quality is what it is, but at the end of the day, one of my metrics is heart. And I mean, it's Denny writing, you know, his character of the 90s. It's Asriel. I gotta assume there was heart involved in this. So, you know, we do the best we can with what we've got. I don't want to be too negative, but we'll take it as it comes, and we will try to keep things light. With all that said, I was afraid that I oversold how dorky the issue was last episode, but upon hearing some feedback, I'm a little bit more comfortable with the way I discussed it because that turns out a lot of people were in agreement, or a handful of people were in agreement. I don't have a whole lot of listeners, but those who do and who write in, they expressed similar vibes and feelings about that issue. Anyway, how about we get into part 2 of 3 here with Asriel, Agent of the Bat number 48, which had a January 1999 cover date. We're in 1999 for now. Story's called Scratching the Surface, written by Denny O'Neill with pencils by Roger Robinson. Inks James Pasco, colors Demetrius Basokos and Prismacolor. Letters Ken Brzezinak, edits Berrios and Carlin. Cover price $2.25. Now, we pick up right where we left off. We're looking at the newly dead body of Senator Esty Hallivan. Old Nick Scratch stands over the corpse and admires his literal handiwork, while his devil-headed goons enter the scene. Now, Scratch threatens to kill them for failing in their mission, but allows them to plead their case. And so they talk of a man, in a cape and a mask, who descended upon them and, well, kicked their asses. Now, while Nick tries to plan his next move, Asriel enters as well, and he introduces himself by name. I've been comparing Denny and Chris Claremont a lot, and that's definitely a Claremont thing, you know, where a character enters a room and says, "You can call me whatever my name is," and it's like, great, thanks for the info. Now, Scratch seems amused by JP's presence here, and he asks what his purpose is, to which Asriel's all, "I am an angel of vengeance." Like, literally, that's his answer. Scratch ain't impressed. I'm not either. But he decides to do the whole Bond villain, you know, let me tell you my evil plan gimmick. Now, you see, old Nick Scratch ain't a friend of Gotham City. But Esty Hallivan was. As such, Esty had to go. And that's really about it. But it's delivered in an almost painfully cringy way. Scratch refers to himself as the sexiest man in America and a rebel rocker. Rebel rocker. And of course, the sexiest man in America like two or three more times. And then he starts screaming bloody murder for help. Nearby, some security guards hear the cries and proceed to run towards Scratch's dressing room. Now you see, he's going to try pinning the murder of a senator on our man John Paul. And, well, that's exactly what happens. You might be wondering, what would Asriel's reaction to this be? Well, he beats the hell out of the security guards like any innocent man might do. He then hot-foots it on out of there. Another hallmark of the innocent, right? Now, once he's out of there, Nick directs his devil-headed flunkies to meet him on stage and fight him. Him as in Nick, not Asriel. He wants the devilheads to beat him up or attack him. Next thing we know, Asriel's running across the stage while some other rock and roller called Moonjob. Oh, God. Moonjob is finishing up his set. And he thanks all the dudes and dudesses in the crowd. Oh, gross. Anyway, Scratch swoops in and dropkicks Asriel and announces to the packed house that the masked man is a murderer. He then stares at him for a good while. Like, literally, it's like two pages of Nick Scratch, like, up close and personal with old JPV, and they're just he's just staring into his eyes. Now, you might think he's got some sort of, like, mind control hoodoo. And hell, for all I know, he might. But this is just a very awkward and, like, painfully elongated scene of Nick Scratch staring into Asriel's eyes. Just then, the devilheads arrive to start beating Nick up, as directed. Nick, in turn, beats the crap out of them, which seems to come as a bit of a shock to the flunkies. I guess you gotta read the fine print there, fellas. Amid the distraction, Asriel is able to get away. As the dust settles, Nick sends his goons out the back way so no one will see them, and just then the security guards come back around. Nick blames the murder of Esty on Asriel and the devilheads. Later, a news report gets some quotes from the sexiest cringe lord in America. He says that Esty was talking about drumming up some funds for Gotham City, and that's when the boys in red attacked. Nick, being the stand-up guy he is, tried to defend the senator, but couldn't save him. He did, however, drive the baddies away, live on stage with 18,000 witnesses. Later still, we rejoin Nick and the Devilheads, who are still wearing their stupid masks, at a nearby hotel. The flunkies ask why Nick didn't fill them in on what was going to happen, to which he responds that he just plain didn't know. But he's got a plan going forward, and by the end of the week, Gotham is going to be the most hated word in the English language. Now this takes us to another hotel room, where Jean-Paul is being visited by the man who sent him here in the first place. Batman tells JP that he's both a liability and a menace, and since he's now wanted for murder, he's going to have to bury the Asriel alter ego. Like, he really lays into JPV here. He says it was a simple assignment, the sort of thing a rookie cop could do, and he effed it all up, and even got the blame for it. Batman says that Gotham City just lost its only friend in Congress. He then tells Asriel that he's done, and tells him to go home. Asriel asks what Batman's going to do if he doesn't, and, well, our man ain't got no time for this foolishness, so he kind of just reminds JP who he is. We close out with Jean-Paul doing the cliche Hamlet pose, holding up his helmet. He says that he'll comply with the Batman's order, but first, he has one thing he must attend to. That's where we leave it. Next time out, mercifully, the last issue of Asriel for a little while. And you know, we don't have a letters page. There is a letters page, it just doesn't have anything to do with any of the books we've talked about. And we also didn't get that from the den that we were promised last time. So, boy, I guess we're up to the point where I have to try to think of things to say about this issue. I don't want to repeat myself. Despite the fact that I constantly do. This was This was so dorky. It just felt so, I don't know, it just felt so tonally different from everything we've covered so far. It really is like this odd outlier that doesn't really have a place, you know? Hopefully, as we get into the actual, you know, No Man's Land proper, it'll be a little bit more, or a little bit less, what it is here. Now, one thing that I can say, and this can go back to the first issue of Azrael we discussed back, it was like episode 4 or 5 of the show. What was that? Azrael number 40, I think. One of the highlights of that for me was the fact that everybody seems to know how little Batman values Azrael as a partner, as a associate, as an acquaintance even. And we had Bane trying to convince Azrael to just join up with him because Batman's got no use for him. You know, once Batman's done, you know, drying his hands, he'll toss the towel away, right? And I do like the way Denny has this sort of, you know, adversarial, acrimonious relationship between Batman and Jean-Paul. I like that old JP is, he's definitely viewed as lesser than, and he kind of knows it. And I appreciate that. I think that's probably the highlight of these, if we can call it that, the highlight of these past couple of issues, where Batman just, he's like, yeah, you can go because you're expendable. And here he messed everything up, and he's like, you're a loser, you're a menace, you screwed this up. I could have sent, you know, a rookie cop to do this, and not only did you mess it up, but now you're taking the blame for what you messed up. And, you know, telling him, burn the suit. And I definitely appreciated that. Unfortunately, it's leading to, yeah, because one thing about Azrael, I do like the costume. But he's not going to have it much longer. He's going to go to this, like, weird head sock thing like every hero had in the 90s. Just, like, 5 or 6 years after they were, we can't say they were in style because they were always kind of goofy looking, but I guess in vogue, you know, where, like, Gambit had his, and it's like, okay, now give every character that head sock. And Jean-Paul's going to get his own take on the head sock, I believe in issue 50. So we're not too far out. Nick Scratch. I mean, you know, there's that whole, like, concept of, like, so bad it's good. He's almost there, but not quite. Like, he's not to the point where we could just kind of laugh at him for being, you know, silly and, like, cringy. It's like, I think we're supposed to take him seriously, which kind of takes the wind out of that sail for me. Maybe as we get to know him, he'll be a little bit sillier, because he just feels like, I'm not even sure how to explain it. He just feels like the sort of character who'd be in, like, a one-off issue of, like, Damage or The Ray, you know? Like some third or fourth string book from the early 90s glut. He would just be, you know, there for an issue or two. Instead, he's like this main mover and shaker who might be ultimately responsible for the government pulling out of Gotham. I mean, is No Man's Land all due to the antics of Nicholas Scratch? I guess we'll find out as we go, but yeah, this was a weird one. This wasn't great, but I don't want to keep kicking it while it's down. So we'll leave it at that. Of course, I want to hear your thoughts. Have you read this? Would you consider reading it? You tell me. And speaking of you telling me, we do have an extra-sized mailbag here, thankfully. Because, well, there wasn't a whole lot to talk about in the book. So we got a couple of longer letters that came in just in the nick of time. Just in the nick scratch of time, I guess. We're going to start with our friend Chris Bailey, who says, "Hey, brother, I've taken my time writing this as I really wanted to capture the feel of the show overall before commenting. As a fan, I was leaning out of the collecting biz at this time. However, Wizard Magazine kept me up to date on what was happening, so I periodically grabbed a few issues along the course of this event to stay current, as digital comics were still in their infancy. And that's exactly what I was doing. Just a year or two before the road to No Man's Land kicked off here, because I had walked away from comics, but, you know, once you have it in your blood, you kind of always have it, right? If you're a comic fan, I remember walking out in 1995 when I was just done. You know, I was through with the hobby, and I've told this story many times before, and the fella behind the counter is like, well, you'll be back. And I was like, nope, I'm done. This is over. I'm out of this hobby. I'm out of this, I'm not going to be reading these, collecting these. I'm done. He's like, nah, you'll be back. And sure enough, didn't take me long, relatively speaking. I was only gone a little while. But while I was gone, I kept up periodically through Wizard. You know, I missed out on, you know, things like the Marvel versus DC, DC versus Marvel, whatever you want to call it, Amalgam, Onslaught. I missed out on all that kind of stuff. I wasn't buying the books as they came out, so I would have to follow what was going on in Wizard. And, Chris Bailey here, he says that digital comics were still in their infancy, but also digital comics news was, you know, pretty new at that point. You know, we had Newsarama, which was, you know, it wasn't what it became. You know, we had, we had CBR, I don't know. But, the digital comics news was, it really was non-existent. You'd have to look in Wizard, you know, and that was like my lifeline to the hobby when I was out of it, and probably part of the, you know, like serving as a gateway drug to get me back in. Bailey continues, I love the concept of banner-wide events, but contained events within a character's respective corners are even better. I didn't jump in on No Man's Land until No Man's Land proper began. I looked at Cataclysm and Aftershock as throwaway events that might pass by the following month. I didn't anticipate how deep No Man's Land would take the franchise. The earlier events were focused on Batman saving folks from rubble, and the villains seemed laughable, particularly our friend the Quakemaster. When No Man's Land proper kicked off, wow, now this is what finally felt like this was going to have some lasting consequences for the titles. Like you, I only read it together in the trades. I haven't had the luxury of reading the floppies. Just kidding. The single issues. You almost had me there. The show covers the event with a great tone, and I can see a huge difference in the energy that I saw when you first covered X-Men in X-Lapsed. The good news is the source material this time is actually good. Where X-Men became an unreadable franchise with no resemblance to a peak X-Men that we all once knew. No Man's Land beats the characters down to a new level we haven't seen before, and everything seems fresh. And, I haven't gone back to listen to, like, I never listen to my stuff once it's done. You know, I'll listen to a few seconds here or there to make sure the sound's okay. But I never go back and listen to my stuff here. I remember when I'm still trying to put together the final episode of The Cosmic Treadmill. I mean, it's been 4 years, and I'm still on the fence about it. I've recorded it a billion times, and it just never feels how I want it. And so, in those situations, I do go back and listen to some of the stuff that me and Reggie did together, you know, just as see if there's a clip I wanted to use or something I can reference in conversation. But, you're not the first person to tell me that my tone is a lot different with this program than what it became during X-Lapsed. Part of me wants to listen to those early episodes because I was psyched to be back reading X-Men and rediscovering X-Men and seeing this like new normal that they were putting together and just how it was controversial, of course, and it was imperfect, but it was the first time in a long time that Marvel actually seemed to care about these characters that pretty much pulled them through the 90s. You know, just because they didn't have the movie rights, they were backburnered and just, I mean, they backburnered them for the friggin' Inhumans, and nobody cares about the Inhumans. It was just silly. So I was really excited just that the X-Men were back. You know, they were back in conversation. People were talking about them. People were excited about them. And I was excited about them. Now, you say here that they became unreadable. I'll say that they became very unfun to read and even less fun to discuss. There are a lot of reasons why I stopped with X-Lapsed. And a few of them had to do with how unfun it became. The X-Men content creation community is very clicky. And there's pressure when talking about new books, new releases, to be very glowingly positive about them. And, you know, we've talked about the 10 out of 10 mentality that reviewers use. You know, they want to keep getting their gift bags, and, you know, more power to them if that's what they want out of what they do. That's not what I want out of it. Like I say, if people are going to dedicate even a second of their day to listening to me, the very least I can give them is honesty. So when I was covering X books that, in my opinion, were not very good, well, it became very unfun, because not only was I not enjoying the stories, not only were there editorial errors all throughout, like these books were contradicting each other, books that came out the same day were contradicting each other. There was like no quality control. It was just glut, you know, shelves full of X glut. None of which felt like they were part of the same story. You know, they were, but they were like looking at it from different angles and not in the good way, you know? So it became very, very unfun to put the show together. And I always had this like voice in the back of my head that told me I was doing it wrong because everybody else loved everything, you know? Everybody else wanted to, you know, be in the gang and have interviews and get their gift bags, but it just became rough. And there's more to this bit of the story that I'm not going to talk about on the air, but there were a lot of reasons why X-Lapsed went away. Here with this program, you know, what little I knew about it from those trade collections, I knew that I enjoyed, or I thought it was just such a gutsy thing for DC and the bad offices to do, and I thought they pulled it off really well. I don't remember much of it, but I do remember enjoying it. And when I put together our list here and saw books like Azrael and Shadow of the Bat, which I totally thought was going to be a down day, but I went into it knowing that it was going to be an uneven ride. And I mean, I even talked about it with folks at the local comic shops, you know, when they'd see me with a big stack of, you know, No Man's Land books, like, oh, have you ever read this before? What are you doing with it? And I would tell them that I was doing a reading project because I don't like to, you know, be like, hey, I've got a podcast, listen to it. I barely promote this show as it is. I don't know how to do that kind of thing without, I don't know, feeling weird. Like, because honestly, I don't know why anybody is listening to me talk right now. But anyway, I would say I was doing a reading project and I would be warned. It's like, it's uneven. You know, if you haven't read all of it, there's going to be some bits that are really great. There's going to be some stuff that's good. And then there's going to be some stuff that you're going to just power through. And I mean, if we're being honest, that's all comics, right? I mean, the average is the average for a reason. You know, comics, by and large, just like anything, any consumable form of entertainment or anything period, the average is average. That's where most of the things are going to wind up. So, yeah, it's I'm happy to be doing this project because I'm going into it with a different sort of mindset than I went into X-Lapsed with. X-Lapsed very much became like a surrogate child for me. And it was an unhealthy relationship, to say the very least. Back to Bailey's message here. He says, on to the aftermatter conversations. When it comes to collecting, filing, and buying habits, I have plenty to say. Let's begin with comics in general. I recognized early on, like any collection, there are habit-based hobbies, there is an addiction mentality that fuels it. I was there. I began collecting what I wanted, just buying my Justice League of America, New Teen Titans, Batman, Legion of Superheroes, and Spider-Man books. It was easy for me to leave issues on the rack that I didn't need. As time went on, I wanted the connecting issues of a story or series to read the full story. In the mid-80s, at the beginning of my comics buying habit, I was easily led by Marvel and DC, and I loved event books and tie-ins. Legends, Crisis, and goddamn Millennium had me buying up everything and anything to maintain the story. They had me. It was a dangerous place, and I recognized it. My $20 a week allowance was stretched to its max, but I kept up as most books were less than a buck. That's 80 books a month, and I soaked it up. I read everything. Flash forward to when I became of working age. The much higher income now fueled an issue. The 90s had begun, and I was literally clearing out the comic racks because I could. I bought DC, Marvel, and all the independents I could get. I began not reading a few things I would buy, and stacks began to form of material that I bought for the sake of buying it. The habit was moving to addiction. And yeah, that is, the thing of it is, like, if I were telling the story that that Bailey's telling now, my story would end there, because I'm still at that point where it's like, you just buy, and there's stacks everywhere. Like, if this was a video, if this was a video podcast, it would be horrendous, because the room I'm sitting in now, I could barely fit in. It's walls of white boxes, stacks of comics. It's a disaster. It looks like the Batquake hit this room. It's very, very... It makes me itch a little bit, but that's where I'm at, you know, where it's like I just buy whatever. And it's like that fear of missing out that people talk about nowadays. And and it's funny because I've had that fear of missing out like smack me in the face on a few occasions. And the one that gets me now is I was buying the Batman books. You know, I was buying every Batman book before Flashpoint. So I was just... I go hot and cold with Batman. You know, Batman was never a... was never a family of books that I needed to have all of, you know? It was just a, okay, I'm going to pop in on Batman for a few years. Okay, I'm tired of Batman, I'm done. And I would actually walk away. Batman and Spider-Man are the characters that I can do that with. I can't do that with the X-Men. I can't do that with a lot of different stories. But with Batman and Spider-Man, I can do that. I can come and I can go. And when Flashpoint was announced, I threw a bit of a temper tantrum and I stopped buying all the Bat books. I stopped buying most DC books. And the last issue, I don't know if I told this story before, I might have, but the last issue of Detective Comics I bought was 879. Now, those who know will know that 880 is a pretty big book. So the like a month before that book came out, I'm like, okay, this is my last issue of Detective. And I've been kicking myself ever since because I can't find the thing for like under $200 now. It's ridiculous. But yeah, one of these days I'll find it, or I'll just splurge on it. But yeah, it's the fear of missing out. I usually say, like, if I ever announce that I'm going to drop a book, everybody who within earshot needs to buy 5 copies of the next 3 or 4 issues of that book, because something big will happen. A new character is going to show up. There's going to be something huge that's going to make those books that I dropped just crank up in value. Like, I think the last issue of I think it's Adjectiveless Spider-Man. I think the last issue of that I bought, or I had pre-ordered, was the one before Spider-Boy showed up. And I don't know how much that thing's going for, but it's more than cover price. So, yeah, anytime you hear me say I'm dropping a book, invest in that title for the next several months, because you'll make your money back pretty quick. Back to Bailey. He says, now move on to the Image launch, the dawn of Valiant, X-Men, X-Force, and Spider-Man explosions, and the era of the rock star artist. I was all in now. The $80 a month had spiraled into $200+ a month. This is where it became scary, because I started buying things I didn't even like, or just wanted to have a certain book. I was a stark raving Overstreet Wizard price guide guy who was pricing the books and keeping up on trends. This lasted until university, which made matters worse, that with now three comic shops to play with and a student loan, I was in deep. After the bubble burst and comics companies closing up shop, I moved into real life with a job and a family, and resources didn't allow me to keep up the crazy volume of books I was buying, so I pared down to the absolute basics. Spider-Man, Batman, a few indies, and all others stopped, minus the random event book or two. I broke the cycle. It wasn't until I realized the trap of collecting, the crazy need to buy everything. I look back at long boxes of crap that I have no connection to. I didn't need Cyber Force number zero. I don't care about Spider-Man power and responsibility. Oh man, I have those too. But that's one of those like real hard looks in the mirror, isn't it? Like anytime I'm in a bin and I see a run of something, I'll pick it up. No matter if I want it, if I have any passing interest in it, it's just silliness. It's that just need. It's that hoarding mentality. It's that little kid who was saving up his lunch money every day to buy whatever he could. Now with the ability to do that on a grand scale, you know, in 50-cent bins with, you know, disposable income. Like, it's like, do I need all 20 issues of the Ray? And I don't mean to pick on the Ray a couple of times in one episode here, but it's like, if I found a run of the Ray, I'm buying the whole damn thing. What is the El Diablo, that Gerard Jones series? I think it went like 18 issues, and I found all of them in a 50-cent bin. And I bought them. And it's like, this was after the Gerard Jones news came out, so it's like, I knew I wouldn't be able to write about it or talk about it. I had no interest in even reading it, but it was like, oh, it's a whole set. And I just bought it. And like Bailey said here, it's like you look at your long boxes and it's like, what in the hell? Why is that here? Why is that here? Why is El Diablo taking up space in my house right now? I don't know. Back to Bailey. He says, like every collection I have, like my outstanding VHS and action figure collections, there comes a time when a fun hobby slips into a bad habit akin to drugs. I'm happy to be out of new comics and that I have no passion for the new material, so I'm out of the cycle. It's empowering. It's freedom. I also love that all the old material I used to collect is mostly available in other formats. I can read it all again and have no need to spend big money on single issues to fill a hole. And you know, compare, like, I think we've all, as comic fans or just collectors in general, we always will be like, oh, you know, drugs would be cheaper. You know, we always make those drug jokes here, but Bailey's point is well taken here. It's when you decide to drop something and like actually stick to it. For me, I can appreciate that I am far more precious than most normal people, even in the comic collecting hobby. But I still remember the night where I put in my DCBS order and I did not include the X-Men for the first time. And like, you know, not to minimize withdrawals, because I've never gone through withdrawals, so I don't know how horrible they can be. But in my own little Nerf ball kind of way, I can compare it to that. I mean, that I didn't sleep that night when I dropped the X-Men books, because I'd been buying them on and off, mostly on, for over a quarter of a century, every single week, you know? And to not do that, breaking the cycle, it like physically hurt. You know, I couldn't stop thinking about it. I couldn't stop wanting to like run back downstairs and fix my order, you know, and put all, it was during the X-Men Blue and Gold series before the Rosenberg stuff and then before Hoxbox. That's when I dropped out because I just couldn't take it anymore. But just knowing that there were going to be X-Men books coming out that weren't going to be in my house, that I wasn't going to have in my long boxes. It was not a good night. It was not a good week. And I still remember that. And I mean, that probably says more about me than anything else. But it's tough to break that cycle. And I respect anybody who can, because I definitely can't. Back to Bailey. He says, as for filing, it's always done in families. Spider-Man will be with Spider-Man, Batman with Batman, and alphabetical within the family, and of course, numerical in order. Everything must be organized in volumes, and each volume starts with a zero and ends with the annuals in the back. We're on the same page there. That's how I've started to do things now. I think I mentioned that my methodology was just stuff, you know, stuff where things fit. So it could have been, you know, a third of the box could have been Ultraverse, then it could have been El Diablo, then it could have been the Ray, and then it could have been Extreme X-Men in one box, because that's what fit. But I've since changed to doing it by family. Like, I'll have my, you know, slew of X boxes and slew of Bat boxes and stuff like that. And of course, I do start with the numerical, you know, first issue, whether that be a zero or a negative one or a one half. That's how I will organize things. And I throw the annuals in the back as well. Bailey continues. As for slabs and things like variant covers, I look at that as a separate and independent hobby unrelated to my era of collecting. I don't want or need it, and there's big power in that. And that's true. That's true. Because I am, you know, I hate to tell people how to collect. You know, it's not what I ever would want to do, because I don't want anybody to tell me what to do. But I am not a fan of slabs. It feels like the industry and the retail arm of it is getting desperate. You know, it's the law of diminishing returns, and we're trying to make things that are not in short supply artificially in short supply, right? It's like, you can have that first appearance of Spider-Boy, but do you have it under plastic? You know, do you have it slabbed with a 9.6 on it? It feels like, and to Bailey's point here, that's a separate thing to me. My eyes never go to the slab wall. I never go to the slab box, because those to me aren't comics. You can't read them. They're just a picture under glass. Definitely not my era of collecting either. And as for variant covers, that just feels like a dead cat bounce. You know, that's an old, like, stock market term, where it's like, you could throw a dead cat across the street, it'll bounce a few times, but it's still dead. You know, it's a way to talk about stocks that are dead, I think. It's been a long time since I've talked about the dead cat bounce, but that was my understanding of it. So it's like, if you're only going to sell 5,000 copies of a book, yeah, well, throw 8 or 9 variant covers on it, you'll get over 10,000. You know, it's artificial. And to me, you know, there at the comic shops, there are variant boxes, you know, but I'm never drawn over to those either, because to me, those are a different thing, just like Bailey said here. Speaking of Bailey, he wraps up with saying, this is a long way of saying great job on the podcast, and I hope this adds to the conversation. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for sharing and writing in, and at the risk of sounding even more precious, I really do miss the conversations we had. I miss chatting with you a lot. So thank you. It means a whole hell of a lot to me that you'd write in and stick with me. So thank you so, so much. We do have one more letter here. It's from our friend CJ, and he's talking about Azrael, the issue we discussed last episode. He says, I haven't read this issue and probably never will, but from your synopsis, it sounds like it's Denny using a version of the playbook he used in Green Lantern, Green Arrow, but without the bite and passion. He was certainly not afraid to single out a political party or figure back then. Or also relevant contextual details. That approach was relatively innovative in superhero comics when Green Lantern, Green Arrow came out. While those GLGA stories are definitely dated, I enjoy them, especially for the Neil Adams art. It seems like this Azrael story has some of the same elements of those GLGA stories. It mixes a political story with a superhero action thriller story, but it's missing the dynamics that made GLGA more entertaining and memorable. It seems to be missing an actual political statement or agenda, and it seems to be missing the stronger characterization of Green Lantern Green Arrow's arguments that Green Lantern Green Arrow's arguments help build, and GLGA are just better characters. And that's true. That's true. I think I said this during the episode, where, like, it feels dated, but it doesn't feel like Denny's old work completely. Like, and there are flashes of it there, but it just kind of misses the mark. And I think you put it very, very well there. It's been a while since I've read Lantern Arrow, but I think they are pretty dated. They were never my favorites. Neil Adams was firing on all cylinders back then, though, for sure. But I always go back to how there were some powerful statements there, right? That kind of missed the mark. Of course, there's that one scene with the purple skins and the blue skins, which I understand what Denny was going for there, but when you're talking to someone who saved the planet and the universe countless times, it's, I don't know, it feels like it misses the forest for the trees. Of course, it's the statement that was trying to be made there, and that's perfectly fine. But the story I always go to in Green Lantern, Green Arrow is like when Ollie and Hal are trying to bust up a tenement owner. Like, there's this dude he's like a slumlord. And it's like, okay, well, this is a bad dude. Let's take him out. And then they find out, it's revealed that this slumlord is like actually an alien, like an evil alien who's trying to just like destroy humanity. And it's like, you missed it by that much, you know, because socially relevant stories, it stands to reason that the bad guy could be your next door neighbor, right? Or the good guy could be your next door neighbor. It's just, it's an examination of humanity and people and how they relate. So you have a slumlord, and I mean, slumlords exist. They're real. And it's like, that wasn't good enough. We had to make him an evil alien. And, just, again, it was the Bronze Age. I'm sure there were people to answer to, especially during that run. As, you know, we've read before how, you know, the Speedy as a junkie story was something that they wanted to do, but DC got cold feet, and then Stan swooped in with his non-code approved book, and then the Green Lantern, Green Arrow story was kind of an also-ran at that point. It was, already been there, done that. Back to CJ. He says, a thought I had about a three-part story. I know you're committed to doing an episode per comic, but I wonder if you'd find more enjoyment and sustainability if you did all three parts for this story arc in one episode. It's too late for that for this story arc, but something to consider if you run into a similar story in this project. Maybe that would irritate some of your listeners who want a more completionist approach, and it might rankle you too, but I think it might be an interesting approach to spend more time on the issues you enjoy. And your point is well taken there. And, you know, last summer, when I was still kind of on the fence about X-Lapsed, but I'd fallen so far behind. Like, I think I was like 80-something issues behind last summer. And the thought of doing an episode per issue was just like, I'm never going to get there. Because Marvel was still putting out 3 to 5 issues a week. And, I mean, there's only so many days in the week for me to put these episodes out. So it would be like, I'd have to do like a morning and afternoon episode, you know? I'd have to do 2 a day in order to catch up. And I thought, okay, maybe I could just do these in clumps. You know, I could do these in arcs. But then, you know, other things got in the way and really just turned me off from reapproaching X-Lapsed in any sort of analytical way. With this program, though, one of the things that drew me to No Man's Land as a project was the length of it. The end of the year, I'm sure this is not unique to me, but I usually fall into a bit of a depression at the end of the year. That's the time where you tabulate everything you did and didn't do, the things you wish you did, the things you wish you hadn't. Being a fake-ass creative person, like I am, and emphasis on fake-ass, I kind of view the measure of myself by my output, whether that be a script, a blog post, something that I'm writing creatively, quote-unquote, for myself, and you just look for ways to define the year, you know? So when I finally decided that we were doing this, I wanted it to last a long time. And at the rate that we're doing it here, where it's, you know, usually 5 episodes a week, you know, I've slipped up a couple times, but it's generally 5 episodes a week. This program should take a little over half a year, which is what I wanted. I wanted something to kind of define what 2024 was going to be for me from a pseudo creative outlook, because I work best when there's a project, and the past couple of years I haven't had one when January 1st kicked over, and it's affected me. It's really gotten under my skin. Years before that, I was doing Chris's on Infinite Earths every single day for something like 2,500 days, you know, so I always had something. And then I did X-Lapsed, and that was every day for like a year and a half. So I had that. This time I didn't have anything, and I really needed something for my own mental health, and actually just plain health, probably. I needed something, and the thought of having this project keeping me on track for most of the year was attractive to me. If I go back to 2019, I was in a similar situation where I felt like I just needed something. And that's when I did Action Comics Daily, where I went through the entirety of Action Comics Weekly for 11 months. Every single day, there was a story from Action Comics Weekly, and it kept me on track. It kept me motivated. And I mean, 2019 is when Reggie had his aortic dissection in May. But I was able to, like, I was able to keep focus. And I was able to do it because Action Comics Daily cost me a lot of readers. Because despite, you know, it's obscure and people think it's kind of cool, but nobody really cares that much about it. So I lost a lot of readers, but I was doing it for me. You know, it's kind of like this show here. I don't expect this to get tons of hits, tons of downloads, tons of anything. But it's something that I'm interested in, and it's going to keep me on track. So I don't think we'll be doing clumps for this. Like I said, the length of this project is one of the more attractive things about it to me. And I mean, we're going to have days like this. You know, we're going to have these like weird Asriel issues. And I'm pretty sure there's going to be, you know, part of the round robin No Man's Land, there's going to be story arcs we don't care for. Or maybe we'll agree on them, maybe we'll disagree on them, maybe it'll lead the conversation, maybe it won't. I mean, it's we take it as it comes, and I'm just happy that, you know, there are people listening and writing in to help, you know, extend these shorter episodes here. I think we're going on like 50 minutes now. And I think I talked about the comic for like 5. So that's all thanks to you guys writing in and giving me something to talk about. And, you know, just being part of the this, you know, silly little community we've got here. CJ continues with, finally, I'm also a fan of Superman's parents being alive. I think Krypton's destruction and his loss of Kryptonian family is enough tragedy for Superman. And instead, Ma and Pa Kent should be a constant source of inspiration, connection, and light for Clark. I, too, loved how the death of Superman portrayed Ma and Pa's reactions, especially Pa's near-death experience slash vision. And I thought that was something that set him apart from the rest of the DC Trinity, and it offers different types of stories than we could get from some of the other big-name superheroes. I agree 100%. 100%. It's, things like tragedy are definitely part of the hero's journey, the hero's story. But we don't need to double down on poor Superman, do we? Like, he lost his planet, and we need to take out his, you know, the people who raised him and instilled their values in him. We need to take them out, too. And I remember the, when I was first, like, trying to be a student of DC, finding out that, like, in the Silver Age, Ma and Pa died from, like, some weird tropical flu. It's like, what? That's just so bizarre and so pointless. And I got really big into collecting and reading Bronze Age Superman over the past, you know, decade or so. Been, you know, filling in holes in action and Superman anytime I find anything that I need. And there is an odd aloofness in those stories that isn't there when post-crisis, when Ma and Pa are still around. like, I don't know, it's hard to connect with the Bronze Age Superman. Of course, you know, there's the whole pre-crisis thing. His powers are incredible compared to post-crisis. You know, Crisis, they say, kind of marvelized Superman. You know, they gave him limitations, they gave him flaws, they gave him, you know, a life outside the cape that wasn't completely reliant on the weird Lois Clark Superman love triangle. But I definitely feel like having Ma and Pa there made, you know, it's weird to consider a character like Superman relatable, but I mean, they are pretty much the embodiment of his human side. You know, they raised him, they instilled their values in him. He grew up with them, learning from them, mimicking them, you know, just being part of this family. And that definitely adds an air of relatability that I don't think any other version of Superman has had. You know, we can go to the New 52, and that was a disaster, in my opinion. Bronze Age, those are fun stories, but they're not, for me, they're not comfortable stories. You know, like there's that comfort food element that the post-crisis Superman has. And, you know, a lot of that, maybe I'm being hyper-focused right now, but I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that, you know, every few issues, you'd get a phone call from Ma, or the photo album. You know, Ma's photo album would be a story, a plot point. I think that did a lot, not only in relatability, but like you pointed out here, differentiating him from the other heroes that were like completely born out of trauma. So we are in full agreement there, my friend. And I thank you ever so much for taking the time to write in. I really, really appreciate it. And of course, speaking of writing in, I invite anybody who wants to join the conversation to do so. You could find me all those different ways. I should just like make a soundbite here for the end of the episode, because I very seldom, I don't really sway from what I generally say, do I? You can find me all those different ways. Chris is on infiniteearth.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com, all those Facebooky type places as well. But I think that's where this very short episode is going to come to an end. I would like to thank you all so much for spending some of your day with me today. And until next time, as always, I will talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to